Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Welcome back to Amplify, to second hour of our program, where our guest is Robert Jensen, who has written a book, Personal Effects, What Recovering the Dead Teaches Me About Caring for the Living. And he writes in his book, and fortunately it doesn't apply to me at this moment. Whenever I am asked certain questions, and I ask them a lot of questions during the first part of our program, whenever I'm asked certain questions, I always ask the person, do you understand the question you are asking me? Because once I give you the answer, you will never be able to not know it. Let's come back to that, Robert, and because we left off with you beginning to tell a story about your grandfather.
We were talking about the meaning of the personal effects, the belongings, and the value. And as I say, when I go into scenes and I have to talk about why spend the money and effort to recover all those items and explain to the authorities they're not items, they're very special things. And when we can't return a loved one, or we can't return a loved one that is in a state that's viewable for families, the personal effects become very important because they're the reminders. They're the things that people are going to go back to when they're wanting to think about their loved ones, or what a lot of people go back to. An example I was using is, as a kid, my grandfather was very special to me. I smoked a pipe, and sometimes I smoke a pipe, and it's always funny how people will come up to me and say, gosh, you that smell of the tobacco reminds me of when I was a kid. And it's exactly what it is for me. I can still have his, I can still picture in my head what he looked like and being with him and what he was saying when he would smoke his pipe. Mm. And so I think that the importance of the belongings are it gives something back to the family that they can have when they don't get very much else back.
And that can also include the recovery of body parts, even though it's a psychologically challenging task, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You don't want to just say it's too hard or not try, and we've expended great resources and risk, as a lot of agencies do, to be able to return the loved ones, because it's so many different cultures and religions. Having the loved ones back is part of the process, and it's making sure that we've not abandoned our family members, we've not left them to the winds. We are doing what is, for a lot of people, a thing they see as a duty to care for their loved ones. Now, that can be problematic at some times, and we have to explain to people what the reality is and why it may take weeks or months to make a recovery. Unfortunately, because of TV and the forensic shows, there's this expectation that these things are done within days or hours on TV. And for us, that's not reality. It can be weeks or months or years. And look at New York City, for example. The medical examiner made a commitment to the families. And he himself, the examiner who was there at 9/11, Curtis, passed. But his office is continuing on to try to make an identification for every person that was reported missing or for every remains that's recovered. And every once in a while, a new fact will come forward. A family reference from DNA is submitted, or a new way to test DNA is developed, and another identification is made. And that's part of that process.
And you point out that you would love nothing more than to say that we're always successful in working with families, but that would be a lie, that we can't always give people what they want when they want. Why is that? Is that because we're all so different?
Well, we're all different. We're all human. Some things just aren't possible, not because we've done anything wrong, but we don't get lucky. We don't make a recovery. We had the case of Alaska Airlines, which was a plane going from Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, with a stop in San Francisco to Seattle, disappeared off the radar in the ocean off the coast of California after some incredible mechanical malfunctions or errors in maintenance. And 88 people on board, and there were four. We just never got any remains that we could identify to recover. Mm-hmm. And that's hard for the families because, again, it goes back to, well, were they really on the aircraft? Well, let's look at the facts. The facts were they were on the aircraft. But I can't give you physical remains. I can show you all the work that's done to establish they're on the aircraft. We can recover their effects. But I can't give you a casket or a coffin. And so it's difficult because it's not possible. And it's helping people hopefully still feel comfortable to get on that bridge with the information you have for them. But it doesn't happen sometimes, and there's nothing that we can do about it.
You were intimately involved, your company, with 9/11, the terrorist attacks. Just give us a kind of overview, maybe from the perspective that does every disaster give rise to some new and needed improvement?
Well, I don't know if there's any new lessons for people to learn. They're just new people learning old lessons. Mm. And I don't mean in the technology that changes, but in the management. 9/11, I think the problems we saw were the typical problems in management of a mass fatality. And I struggle to think for a moment. The impact was big for the United States. The impact was big for the world. And the positive of 9/11 is that it wasn't an attack that succeeded. It succeeded in killing thousands of people, but didn't succeed in dividing people or making people hate. I don't think it actually created the opposite opportunity for people to come together. I think the challenge goes back to, though, the inevitable making sure that everything is open and transparent so that there aren't the questions about the conspiracy theories. There aren't things that give rise to doubt or to detract from the event later on. So I'm not sure I've answered your question. If I haven't,
sure,
ask me again. I'll try.
Yeah. No. And you took time with your daughter because you weren't quite sure what was going through her mind. And you told her that these things will happen if we allow them to happen.
Yeah, I had because again, I never wish upon anyone the things I've seen and done. And I had with my my daughter at the time was very young, and people asked me, how do you do this? Or what does the toll this job take on you? And I explain that the toll is probably more on the family and on the ones around me than on me. And at one point, if you'd asked my daughter, she gave me one Christmas, explained to people as a present or made a description of my job. And she says, yeah, Dad gets a phone call and he leaves and he flies to an airport,
yeah,
and he waits for a phone call and he goes somewhere else.
Right.
And then one time, my ex-wife told me the story. She was talking to my daughter and she said, to my daughter, Daddy will be home this weekend. And my daughter said, no, Mom. Dad said he's planning on being home. And, and this was probably a little bit later when she was a teenager. And she was so used to me always being gone. And even a commitment didn't necessarily mean it was a commitment that would be fulfilled. And on 9/11, which had been a rough year to begin with, that year we'd had some big events that were still going on. And I was pulling out the driveway when the and my was my wife at the time ran out and said, well, a plane's just hit the tower. So, okay, well, I'll go to work. And by the time I got to work, of course, I then spent several hours on the phone with the government about plans as what they thought was going to occur, what did hurt, you know, what did happen. And so I knew I'd be leaving that night with our portable morgue, and we were going to the Pentagon, is where we were first headed. And so I didn't know when I'd be home, because I, having been in the Army, I'd go to work on some days and then not come home for 4 weeks.
Wow.
So they were used to that, but I knew at least I had an opportunity to see her for a few minutes and to say, look, this is bad, but, you know, we're strong people. People around the world are strong. And just like the other things that you won't remember because of your age, the sun will still come up tomorrow. And the good things will still happen. And then I left because, you know, people were at home watching on TV. People were talking to each other and helping process. For me, I don't get that opportunity because I'm now in, okay, what do we need? How many refrigeration containers? Where are we going to need
assets?
Where are we going to need people? What type of people? What are the things that I need to tell the government and the agencies that are calling me from experience to consider and think about? So I don't go to processing loss. I go to responding.
Yeah, there isn't a religion that says we shouldn't be caring people. In the chapter on death and truth, you write, I describe the response to a mass fatality as like working within a situation that is triangular, and I need to maintain a perfect triangle in which all of the angles are equal. By that, I mean there are always three things you have to keep in mind and keep balanced. One angle is the deceased. They have a right to dignity, respect, and an identity. The second angle is the living, the survivors, the families, and the communities, like a school that loses a group of students or village that loses many residences. The third angle is investigation. In criminal cases, survivors and families will want someone held accountable. In an accident, they will want to know change will be made to prevent the same accident from happening again. At times, these three needs will have competing interests, and that balance can be difficult. Why is that?
Well, you take, for example, Lockerbie, the bombing that occurred in December 1988, the Pan Am Flight 103. It's a bomb that went off over land, so the plane is scattered. There's people in the village of Lockerbie that were killed. There's damage to that, and there's this wreckage, and then among this wreckage are human remains. So if we run right in to collect the bodies, dignity, get them out off the ground, out of view, we may step on that little tiny piece of microchip that's going to have the answer or lead us back to a bomber, as it did in Lockerbie. And so you've got to figure out how can I meet the needs of the investigation? Because I've got police saying, well, you've got to do everything over time, but I've got family members who are saying, well, what about our loved ones? And so it's important to say, what can you do to meet all the needs? So can I bring religious figures as an example to come in and say words over the site? Can I cover the deceased? And then more importantly, the most important thing, can I explain to the families why things are being done? Not as an afterthought, but as a priority. Because a lot of the confusion or anger comes not from the action, but not understanding what is occurring and why, because no one bothered to tell them.
Yes. And you, throughout the program, have talked about how important the truth is. Truth is so important. And yet we live in what you refer to as a post-truth world. How challenging does it make your work and others like you?
Oh, you know, I love technology, the cell phones, computers. I mean, you look at the things that we have now that as old or as young as I am, we didn't have and wouldn't even have imagined and can't imagine what's going to be next. But with it comes a challenge for individuals to manage their own responsibility. And I think we've lost a little bit of that. People don't want to read beyond two lines. They don't want to look into the detail, and they don't want to understand the context. And so we get a snapshot, and we run off and take action going in the wrong direction because we haven't given ourselves a chance to look at the facts. And we're impatient. We want something. We want to know it now, and we want the answer now. And by gosh, if we're not going to get it right now, then I'll come up with the answer that I like best. Mm. And this goes back to kind of what is to me an individual responsibility, but also how the system has evolved, the system of communication, of training, education, is we have to go back that sometimes we're going to have to wait. Sometimes we need patience. And part of what I do as an example, when I brief families that in back, because you know, people are, well, there's all the speculation. It's like, let me give you an example of what it takes to do a report. And I'll use maybe Swiss Air 111, which crashed off Halifax. And this was a, gosh, three-year investigation by the Swiss and the Canadian authorities. $28 million worth of work just for the investigation to get to the facts. And so I try to say, so if we're trying to get to an answer today, you're not going to probably get the correct answer. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to learn things that aren't true. And then you're going to have trouble separating what truth is from reality. So let's spend time instead on the process. Let's understand the process so that we know when we get an answer, it's the real answer.
Yeah, you indicate
that works.
Yeah, you indicate that you've often been a fan of the media and have often seen them as partners in the response. But you also talk about the many ways of the soon-to-be-dead say their last goodbyes in the modern world. What are some of the kinds of messages that are left? We have a couple minutes before we take our next break.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are people who know they're going to leave.
Yes.
And they make, you know, they make their wills, they make their testaments, or do their videos. They bring families in to say goodbye. Always are poignant and touching, and those aren't, unfortunately, the situations we don't get to see. But there are people who probably know they're not going to survive, and the phone calls, the messages on the answering machines, the last notes that are written. And this is where, when I'm doing a burial, a mass burial at the end, I always take a few minutes to myself, and my wish is that at the last minute, I hope they did find the peace that probably eluded them in life.
Well, and you're right, let me read us out to our next break-in. You write that one of the things that has always bothered me is the high number of unidentified dead in the world, along with the equally high number of missing persons. Part of this problem is the lack of training for first-line responders. Bodies and the locations where they are recovered from often contain a lot of information. But just like learning and understanding a foreign language, it requires skill and practice to see and understand that information, the nuances and the subtle things that make a big difference. And you write that seeing a dead person for the first time, especially one that is decomposed or has suffered some type of trauma, is difficult and can be a lot that and that almost as important as the recovery of the deceased is the gathering information about how they died, that people want to know what happened, and they want, here we go again, the truth. Our guest is Robert Jenkins. We're talking about his book, Personal Effects, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify, where our guest is Robert Jensen. I've talked about as much about the book as I can. It goes a lot deeper and with great feeling, with great caring. Personal Effects, title of the book, What Recovering the Dead Teaches Me About Caring for the Living. How do you remember so many details of what most people might like to forget? I mean, it's throughout the book. It was amazing to me how you remember all of this.
And some people would love to have a photographic memory, and I'm not sure mine is photographic. I think you'd classify it as near photographic, and in my case, it's probably as much a curse as it is a benefit. I just see stuff, and that's what I remember.
I think it's caring, really. I think it is caring. And there's a lot of places where you can remember things. You can remember them in your mind, in your brain, or you can remember them in your heart. Or, as is the case, the mind and the heart are really united in some way that we still don't fully understand. And I think you're on both sides of that equation. As you point out, you indicate that when managing a mass fatality morgue, you try to operate it as if the family were standing right next to you, right next to us when you say it as a company. That would be one of the examples. Now, you point out that there have been stunning advances in DNA testing in recent years, and we couldn't do what we did with Osama bin Laden less than 10 years ago. Are things really moving that quickly?
Oh, absolutely. With rapid DNA, digitalization of records. I mean, the first big thing, because a lot of identifications are still made through fingerprints and dental records, but before those were digitized, it took a lot longer. Now, with records being digitized, we have sensors that we can take into the field to put into a human remains, a jaw, to get an X-ray image if we're worried that moving the body is going to cause the jaw to be destroyed because of, you know, damage from fire or something like that. And we can, you know, make an identification before we even got the deceased back to the morgue. So technology has really made it easier in that sense, but it still makes it a lot of information to go through, which means it still takes time. And unfortunately, again, that's the perception from families is this can be done quickly. But it also creates other problems for us because sometimes we get information we weren't looking for, such as finding out that when we do the DNA, that a family member is not the relationship they thought they had. They're not a biological family member. Now, for me, I don't define family just by biology. I define it by a whole lot of other things. But unfortunately, that can have a legal impact on who can make disposition instructions, and it can create a burden for how much information is shared. And when I talk about making sure we always answer the questions that are asked and telling the truth, again, it goes back to, I think, a passage you read. We need to know that the people asking the question understand what the information will mean to them.
Right.
And one of the questions I always get is, well, did they suffer? Did they feel anything? And I think it's not asked like that. It's more asked, were they alive at the time of impact or detonation? And, well, if you mean alive versus aware, life is defined by a doctor is a little bit different than life is defined by others. So was there physical life? Yes. Was there awareness? No, because of some of the impacts of the G-forces and things like that. So was there suffering? I don't think they were aware, so I don't think they suffered, but I don't know.
You write the survivors, and this is in the chapter called A World of Pain. The survivors and families attending know what has happened. What they don't know is the why, but that is not their biggest concern. Their biggest concern is about what is next, and what does it mean for them in a practical sense? This is where most companies and governments get it wrong. In essence, they are trying to defuse a bomb that has already gone off. Families know mistakes happen, and they will deal with that over time. What they expect, what they have the right to expect, is that a response will focus on managing the consequences of the incident. Yes, briefing can be very emotional. And so your position is that there really should only be one data center. Say a little more about that.
Oh, absolutely. The data centers, when a mass fatality occurs, a boat sinks or a train accident or, you know, fire in a building, earthquake, there needs to be a call center. And there can be multiple call centers, but everything needs to point to one database, because what the system's trying to do is find out who is missing and paint a picture about that person, because that information is going to be used, one, to help with the identification, and two, to help go from a funnel. And think of a funnel as at the top. There's a whole lot of people asking questions and want information for a specific person who's missing. But each person that's missing is going to have a legal next of kin, a person who's authorized to direct disposition of the remains, a person who's eligible to receive the effects. And the system has to narrow that funnel down to that one person. And the hard thing for me, and I'll digress a little bit if I can for a minute, Monsignor, is
sure.
That people think of family units. And what they forget is a family unit may not have all the same next of kin. And one of the most tragic cases that we went through was an air crash in Libya with a family that, so you had a husband and a wife and a child, or two children in this case, and all four were deceased. So the wife, her parents were, I believe, Dutch. So they became her legal next of kin, the person authorized direct disposition of their daughter's mortal remains, and one half of the grandchildren. The husband, his parents became their legal next of kin, and one half of the grandchildren. So the family in the Netherlands says, we'll take our daughter and our grandkids, and the family in South Africa says, well, we'll take our son and the grandkids. Libyans are, they're not Libyans, so it's not our problem.
Mm.
So who's going to be in charge, though? Is it the Dutch? Is it the Libyan? Is it South Africans? Well, this is what I mean going back to, well, who is in charge? Is it first come, first serve? Who's ever identified first? Is it, you know, who's ever going to yell the loudest? It's none of that. It's the honest broker. It's people like us who come and say, okay, we can say the daughter should go with her parents. The son can go with his parents. The grandkids, you can go to The Hague. You can go to a court that will recognize all three jurisdictions. You can each have a child, or you can go back and say, what would the children have wanted? The people who chose each other, who chose to live together, who chose to create human life and raise that life, what would they want?
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the challenges, but that's why you need the data, because you need to know who's who, so you can anticipate where there might be some challenges. Now, 85% of the families, it's very straightforward. 15%, I think, can be, you know, can be a challenge sometime. And that's why for myself, because I have probably, you know, the poster child for, I'm going to call fractured families or differences, because I have. And I have a mother and a father divorced, don't talk to each other, wouldn't agree on anything. I have an ex-wife, and I have a daughter, and I have a husband. So, you know, that, and I have a sister that's married to a foreign national, so she's now half Australian. And then, you know, so those are all the challenges that our society reflects. And the best answer would have been, well, what if I had prepared a document to tell the people left behind, what would I have wanted to make it easy so we don't have to have the family fights?
Yeah.
And that's what the data, the information center is about, trying to do is collect that information. The second part is also helping with the practical things. I was doing a brief once in Cairo after the loss of a flight coming from Paris to Egypt. And nobody wants to do these briefings, so I often do them, even though, you know, I can barely master English, let alone a second language. And after the briefing, and I had to tell the family members that this wasn't a missing plane anymore, because it had been found and wreckage and human remains, so there weren't going to be survivors. I had to break that news to them. And then afterwards, you know, I had one of the women come and said, I have to go home and tell my husband, why? We don't have three kids, we have five. Mm. And I have to go tell my nieces and nephews that their mom and dad aren't coming home. How do I do that? That's the practical help people need. They don't call their lawyer first. These are the things that companies, governments, agencies have to think about and be able to address.
You acknowledge that you've learn that it's best not to dwell on the devastation all around you. And you speak then about resilience. You write, being prepared for a disaster is really not that hard. It means accepting that bad things will happen, building up resources, and when things do occur, reacting appropriately. Some people argue that as a society, we've become rather soft. If we want something, we only have to click a link on our phone and it's delivered to our doorstep. We complain and post bad reviews if our food delivery is a few minutes late. Psychologists have even identified a nervous disorder, quote-unquote, phone separation anxiety, that people suffer from when they are parted from their cell phones for even short periods. Our problem is not that we are soft or hard, but that we have a lack of patience and confidence, a lack of leadership, and a lack of self-responsibility, a lack of discipline, and the inability to use knowledge while at the same time ignoring facts. Today, more people have access to more information than at any other time in history. But in the sense of understanding history, of studying the past and learning what may await us in the future, people generally don't have the discipline to read beyond the headline or take the time to understand all that it actually means. Tell us a little bit about, then, the importance of resilience.
Oh, absolutely. And I know that some of that may sound harsh to people. It's my experience that people, and let me give an analogy. You go back to, I was in the Army, and so part of my training, we had these wonderful individuals called drill sergeants. And drill sergeants never asked you how you felt and never asked you if you could do anything. They told you to do it, and you did it. And even when you didn't think you could do it, you've actually found out you probably had a little bit more within you. And if you tried, you could do it, and you could be a lot more successful. And we don't have that as much anymore. And I see people quitting before they need to. And I see people that are stumped because they're losing some of the skills to problem solve, and they're confusing convenience with necessity. We lose power. If I need power from a dialysis machine or an oxygen generator, well, that's not a convenience. That's a life-threatening thing. I need power because I'm hot, because I'm bored. Well, then I think we've lost some of the big picture views on what we're supposed to be able to do in life. And that's what I was trying to say there.
Okay. Why has the so-called new normal been the norm for years for you?
Because I see change every day, or most days. I go through things. I'm at work one day in an office, and the next day I'm deployed. I use the example that I was in Bosnia, and I went in 95, and just as or before the Dayton Accords were signed, so I was in well ahead of a lot of the forces. And I would walk through areas where there were mines and try to, of course, stay in the marked paths, and I'd walk through villages that had been emptied out, and there were no young men. They were all either dead or had escaped and gone. And then one day I flew out of Tuzla because I had to go to Zagreb for a meeting, and I'm back in a four-star hotel. So I'm going from being in the mud and the snow and worried about, where the next round's going to come from or who's going to do what. And then I'm in a five-star hotel ordering room service watching, a TV show or three-star, but mm-hmm. I think you know what I mean. So my life has been extremes. And so to survive, you adjust. You know that what's normal today may not be normal tomorrow. And I think that hopefully people don't have those same extremes, but there are changes and there are transitions. And I think, when people talk about COVID, well, I can't wait till it gets back to where it was before. Well, it's never going to come back. Nothing ever goes back to the way it is before. Mm-hmm. So to adapt, you have to accept the change and figure out how do you live with the change and how do you embrace the change or be part of it.
And part of your advice to us is that one thing politicians, planners, and ordinary people need to remember is this. We don't control nearly as much as we think we do. Mass fatalities and crises expose that fact like nothing else. We have to learn to accept that fact in a way we generally don't at the moment. But we also have more ability to respond than most of us realize. Don't fight the things you can't control. Focus on the things you can. Kind of real practical advice, isn't it?
Well, that's what I hope people take away from the book. I wanted the book not to be just a collection of stories, but something that would hopefully help people think, well, if I ever had to deal with this, how would I deal with it from a practitioner standpoint? And then for an average person, I hope never deals with it. What can I do differently now? Or I know I might have a forest fire in the area I live in, or there might be an ice storm, or we might lose power. How do I deal with that? Or how do I not have the anxiousness or anxiety I have? How do I deal with COVID? And again, it's learning that there's many things you can control, and that's why not to be afraid of bad things that are happening, but understand what they are and how to be prepared, not for the event, but for the consequences. And there's some of the smaller things. Again, some people it can be difficult for, others it hopefully helps. And that's, you go to a hotel. Mm-hmm. I count the number of rooms from my door to the exit. So that yeah. If there's smoke and fire and I can't see, I can get on the ground and I can count the number of doors and know I'm going to have the exit. I want to give myself the best chance I can to survive. I don't want to be there a victim of circumstances.
You write that the average life expectancy of Americans is dropping for the first time in living memory. I didn't realize that. And you continue, there's a cultural anxiety around crisis management, but the best way to alleviate anxiety in such events is better preparation, as you've just been explaining, not just at the government level, but at the individual level, and then with good, consistent information once the event has occurred. Yeah, I cut you off there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think I interrupted you. Yeah, that, exactly. I mean, I think it was last year or just the year before that CDC and the people do all the morbidity, mortality studies had adjusted life expectancy down, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But to me, I also see huge numbers of people trying to deal with uncertainty and anxiety and a lot of the responses to Medicaid, and I don't think that's the best answer. I don't think it's the only answer. I think, again, helping people understand, how do you prepare and how do you respond? You look at the history of this country and many countries, the adversity that our forefathers overcame and the things that were accomplished, why should we be trying to do less? Or why should we be making it harder if things are supposed to be easier?
Right. Our guest has been Robert Jensen. The title of the book is Personal Effects, What Recovering the Dead Teaches Me About Caring for the Living. Robert, from my perspective, I can hear the caring in your voice, so I know that it's real. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's been wonderful to have you.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thank you for the kind comments.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
So, some closing thoughts from his book. Anxiety, the fear of what is going to happen, can be debilitating. Stress can have very serious health impacts, and medication doesn't treat the core problem. Actively working to mitigate the damage can help reduce that stress because it makes you feel empowered and less like a helpless bystander. And of course, the things you can actually do help the recovery after the event. Likewise with terrorism, disastrous events are always stressful, but just because you are stressed, staying up all night to see if the storm hits or the floodwaters rise, doesn't mean you are not resilient. Resilience comes with time, experience, education, and preparation. There's also a big difference between stress and panic. You see, look at it this way. Exercise your muscles and your cardio system. You will sweat and feel stiff after a few workouts, but it makes you fitter over time and better able to cope with future challenges. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.